This is Adrian Paul, Duncan MacLeod from Highlander, and you're listening to Blood of Kings on the Fandom Podcast Network.
Hi, everybody. This is Carmel McPherson, President of Highlander Worldwide. Please join us for the Highlander 25th Anniversary Convention, The Gathering, in Los Angeles, California, October 20th to the 22nd. You're listening to Blood of Kings on the Fandom Podcast Network.
Welcome, Highlander fans, to episode 48 of Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network. On this show, we discuss all things Highlander, including the movies, the TV series, novels, audiobooks, games, guest interviews, special events, our very first Chamoli's Choice, episode pick, and more. I'm Norm, one of your Blood of Kings hosts. However, I don't do this alone. Kevin is on a Watcher's Field assignment this week, but have no fear, I have the one, the only, Blood of Kings editor extraordinaire, and my fellow Highlander aficionado. With me is my co-host, Mike, the immortal Chamoli himself, Mike Sellers. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, Norm, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you doing, my friend?
It's a little hot here in Jersey today.
The Jersey heat.
The Jersey heat and humidity. You're out in California, so you don't know anything about humidity anymore.
Humidity, no, but it's a little kind of like Tombstone, that nice dry, like the dry heat, man.
Oh, that's I take the dry heat over the humidity any day.
There you go. So we actually have a really good show for all the fans tonight because, as you know, from time to time, we have these really great episode picks, and just to tease it out a little bit, Mike, because he had this great choice and because he has kind of the editor's prerogative, he chose something really special for this show. And this is our very first Chamoli's Choice. Now, Mike, why is Chamoli a significant name for all the fans who may not know this particular name for you?
Well, Chamoli is a character in like an episode that it's a really goofy episode because the guy gets his powers. Like, he doesn't know what's going on. He becomes like a magician in a circus and like does all these death defying things. It's because he's an immortal. He doesn't know he can die. And like I said, it was just a very kind of goofy, you know, fun episode with Amanda and Duncan. So
it was, but just most importantly, what's the name of the episode?
The Immortal Chamoli.
That's right. And that's also your Twitter handle, if I'm not mistaken.
It is now, thanks to the bet that Kevin made with me.
Of which
he still owes.
There's something special that's going to happen with that. And when that happens, I can guarantee you it's worth the wait.
Okay.
Guarantee you. Yeah. So before we get into the show, I just wanted to thank all the fans that have been supporting Blood of Kings and all the new fans that are supporting Blood of Kings, because our listenership is growing, and all of the fans that are coming onto the Blood of Kings fan page is growing on a daily basis, and we're so very thankful for all of you who have come to support the show. You can always find Blood of Kings on fpnet.podbean.com or on the FPNet Podbean app. You can also find us, the Fandom Podcast Network, on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbeans, Google Play for Android users. Now, I just want to clarify something for all of our fans out there, is that we are part of the Fandom Podcast Network. Blood of Kings can be found on the Fandom Podcast Network. So if you're on iTunes, please search Fandom Podcast Network so you can find our show as part of the master feed. You can also find us on Instagram at Fandom Podcast Network and at Blood of Kings Pod. You can find us on Facebook, of course, on our very, very robust page that is growing every day, the Blood of Kings, a Highlander fandom group. And you can also find a lot of us on our sister page, Blood of Kings, a Highlander CCG, that is collectible card game page. Now, if you'd like to contact us directly, you can email us at bloodofkingspodcast@gmail.com. You can also tweet us on Twitter at Blood of Kings Pod. We love tweets. You can message Kevin directly on Twitter and Instagram at Spartan_Phoenix. You can also message me that way at Starfighter1701. And Mike, how can our fans get in touch with you?
If they want to hit me up on Twitter, I'm under the at Immortal Chimoli.
At the we just mentioned before, at Immortal Chimoli. Yeah. And when you listen to us on iTunes, please leave us a review so that we can generate some higher visibility on iTunes. Higher ratings lead towards higher reviews, and any review is helpful. Of course, we would love a 5-star review. That's the highest level of review that you can give a podcast. So if you like what you hear and you are an iTunes user, please make sure that you leave us a review on iTunes, and I will talk a little bit about a special contest that we have just in a moment as we discuss some of the things that are going on around our network. And but before we do that, we have a little bit of a tease. And Mike, I'd like to kind of prompt the audience a little bit with what we're going to be talking about tonight on the show. So this is Chimoli's choice, your choice. With just a little bit of a tease, not getting into it too much, why did you choose Take Back the Night as your choice?
Well, I've always been a big history buff, and that's one of the other reasons why I like Highlander besides the swords. And I just always found, and also I like the Scottish heritage. So the whole thing with Caerdwen, the immortal that it's in the episode Take Back the Night, I've always just found it very fascinating, and just that was, I just always loved that episode. It's like a standalone kind of episode. There, in every season, I think there's like some, you have your two-parters and your crossover things when they go from Vancouver to Paris. But every now and again, you're just going to get some nice standalone episodes. Like, you guys have covered a few really good ones recently with like Shadows and the Mortal Sins and things like that. So, like, this has always been one of my favorites. So I figured, like, well, I want to talk about the one I want to talk about.
And you have that prerogative because, again, ladies and gentlemen, Mike does such a great job. He works so hard for us behind the scenes on Blood of Kings. Editors are kind of like drummers. You know, they keep the band going. You know,
well, I used to be a drummer, too, so.
Well, there you go. Because he keeps the band going. He keeps us in rhythm. He makes us sound better than we probably do when we record. So this is one of those, I'm going to pull rank, and I'm going to take it by the reins, and I'm going to take my choice, and I'm going to say, hey, you know what? This is something that the listeners, I think, should listen to. So before we get into the meat of the topic, I think that there's something that we need to do, Mike, and I think that we need to head on over to Joe's.
Sounds like a plan.
So here are our Joe's, and I think, Mike, maybe you should, like, you know, hey, you know, this Joette doesn't really see you rarely, if often. So the last time we were at Joe's, we got a chance to go all the way back behind the velvet curtain and behind the velvet rope and hang out at the very special gaming room that he made just for us, or
right.
At least he says he made just for us. So let's walk back over there and maybe drop off our order before we hit the velvet behind the velvet behind the velvet rope, and talk about what's going on with Highlander today. And we're really proud to support the Sword Experience, Adrian Paul's Sword Experience, and we always love updating what's going on with the shows, with his events, and what's going on there. So as we record this show, in September 2nd in Sacramento, California, at the Sac Anime Con, the Sword Experience has been doing what they do best there. And, of course, at the Highlander Worldwide 25th Anniversary Convention on October 20th in Los Angeles, California, there's going to be a Sword Experience opportunity for you all to involve yourself with there. And believe me, if you haven't done it yet, this is something that you're going to want to do, especially there because we're at a special anniversary convention. So the anticipation and the emotion and the excitement is at an all-time high for that. On October 28th, we have Baton Rouge, Louisiana at FIFOCon, and November 10th in Providence, Rhode Island, we have the Rhode Island Comic Con. So make sure that you go to theswordexperience.com to be up to date on all of the scheduling that is happening. Adrian works tirelessly to bring you new events, and an event may be coming near you that you may not know about because he always adds new events to his page. Also, on social media, he always asks to see where else should we appear. And if you go to theswordexperience.com and maybe contact them either there or on Facebook messaging, hey, let him know where you want to go, where he needs to end up, and train you, because, you know, he's hit different places. I think he's maybe returning to Chicago pretty soon. So you never know. Make a loud noise, a joyous noise, and he may show up at an event near you. Now, as I mentioned before, the big thing happening, Mike, is the Highlander 25th Anniversary Convention in Los Angeles, California, on October 20th, Friday, October 20th, to Sunday, the 22nd. But even just as exciting as that is the Thursday before the convention, that Thursday, that would be October 19th, and there's going to be a Blood of Kings Anniversary Convention meetup that's on Thursday, October 19th, from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Crown Plaza Hotel Lobby and Restaurant. We actually created a link on our Facebook page on Blood of Kings, so make sure that you see what's happening there, and please join us. It's going to be a fantastic event. We're going to have fun. We're going to have prizes. We're going to have trivia. Let's see. I'm sure Kevin's going to eat something that is, I don't know, maybe around the level of like 1,000 units of cholesterol. I'm probably going to be drinking something that is wildly awesome for me. And speaking of which, I would like to dedicate this segment of the show to my good friend Monty Kroll, who bequeathed to me a bottle of Four Roses single barrel, which is what I'm drinking right now at Joe's. And, Mike, is there anything special that you're having here at Joe's that the audience can either know about or send you maybe as a nice, you know, what do they call those things? Special care packages in the mail?
Plate of disco fries and a nice cold beer.
Let's see if we can get those to you fresh. I don't know about the disco fries in the mail. They might like, soak through
the box will be all gooey and melting.
You know, I can't wait until the next time I make it out to New Jersey, where I actually have time to hang out with you and go to the Dover Star, where we used to hang out and talk about Highlander.
Sounds good.
You know, and then when we do that, I promise you, we'll have a recorder. We'll sit down. We'll have the disco fries. We'll go to a place and have a beer, maybe shoot some pool, and we'll record ourselves and talk about Highlander like we did in the old days.
Oh, that would be glorious.
Yeah, those were good times.
And that we also have cool to bring some decks and play some CCG.
Absolutely. That's, of course we would. We would never miss the opportunity to do that. So again, on the 25th anniversary convention, that is on Friday, October 20th to Sunday, October 22nd at the Crown Plaza, Los Angeles International Airport, please make sure that you're following all the updates on the worldwide Highlander Worldwide official website. That's highlanderworldwide.com. They are also on Facebook, so make sure you follow them on the Facebook page. But most importantly, here are the confirmed guests, Mike. And I know that this kind of like grinds your gears a little bit, since you told me that you won't be able to make it. But for all the listeners out there that are coming that need to know who the guest list is, here is the guest list. Or maybe this will entice you to come. So we have these confirmed guests. We have Adrian Paul, Duncan MacLeod, Elizabeth Grayson, Amanda, Jim Burns, you know, Joe Dawson, F. Bron McAsh, the Swordmaster for Highlander, David Abramowitz, the senior writing consultant and script coordinator, Anthony DeLongis, who played Ottavio Canzoni and Lyman Curlow, and also the choreographer for Duende, James Horan, who was just recently added as, you know, he's Grayson, and I know you love Grayson.
Mm-hmm.
And just most recently added, we had Stan Kirsch as Richie Ryan, and hopefully, if his schedule allow, we will have Peter Wingfield, Mythos, and John Mosby told me that there are going to be some really interesting announcements as we get towards or closer to the event. So please, please, please make sure that you always stay tuned to HighlanderWorldwide.com and follow what's happening there with the updates. And as I mentioned earlier, we do have a special contest, Mike. We have a special contest for iTunes reviews. And as we are running this contest, and it started on July 3rd, and we're running it to the end of September, what we want to do is we want to encourage people to leave us iTunes reviews. And as I said, if you leave us an iTunes review, it helps increase our visibility on iTunes, especially when it comes to people looking for Blood of Kings. Now, remember, you will find this on the master feed on the Fandom Podcast Network on iTunes. So if you would like to leave us a review, that's where you'll find us. Go to iTunes, search Fandom Podcast Network. You will find us in the master feed. Now, the more creative your review, the better your chances will be as being picked for one of the winning entries. And we want good, honest reviews and critiques because we want to know what you think of the show and how we can make our show content better for you. But most importantly, here's what you're going to win. If you are chosen, if that review is chosen for the winning entry, you will get your own fan pick episode, kind of like what we're doing right now with Chamoli's pick. So we had some really fantastic shows that we've done previously on Blood of Kings. We had Vince Stefanelli's choice for Mortal Sins. We had Jill Burticus's choice with Shadows. We just recently did Sean Dempsey's choice with The Valkyrie, and now we're doing Mike's choice with Take Back the Night. So these are so much fun for us. They're two-part episodes. We do an in-depth review like we're doing now, or we will be doing, and then we will do the commentary. And these are some of the most fun shows that we do. So please make sure that you get your entry in. And at the end of September, we will choose that winning entry, and you will get your chance to pick your own two-part Blood of Kings episode. So all that said and done, Mike, I'm putting you in the hot seat. I'm glad I'm not in the hot seat this week. Because here we go. Your very first, I don't think it's your very first, but your very first solo.
Okay. Right?
Your Immortal Challenge. So here we go. The Immortal Chamoli's Immortal Challenge. And I don't know, I personally like this because it kind of fits in a little bit with what we're talking about today. So I'm giving you a little bit of a hint there. Kevin doesn't give me as much. So I'm going to prime this for you.
Except when he screws up and says whether it's male or female.
Right. Well, that's hard because like in the write-ups, you kind of have to like dance around those pronouns a little bit. But
right.
I'm going to say, okay, so this immortal was born in 441 BC in Rome. He grew up in one of the biggest empires in world's history and became a soldier for the Roman army, eventually rising to the rank of general. He experienced his first death, killed by Gauls in 390 BC during the sack of Rome. He then became immortal and met Flavius Sulla, who taught him all about being immortal. The teachings he acquired with Sulla were transmitted to his first pupil, and even as an immortal, he remained a Roman general for generations. I'm pretty sure if I read this next paragraph, I'm going to tip my hand. So I'm going to anyway because it's only fair. He led his armies into Egypt, falling in love with Nefertiti, Cleopatra's handmaiden, who was also an immortal. When the Egyptians were conquered by the Romans and Cleopatra committed suicide, Nefertiti felt betrayed by this immortal, never forgiving him for destroying everything she cared about. He pleaded with her to come with him so they could live together, but instead she decided to be closed inside a sarcophagus forever in Cleopatra's honor. Do I need to continue?
No.
... So, Mike, who is this immortal?
It's Chamoli.
No, it's absolutely 100% wrong.
Marcus Constantine.
I knew you would get that as soon as I said Nefertiti.
I had it like about, not too long into the description. So,
as soon as I said Roman.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love Mark. Don't you love Marcus Constantine, though, as a character? Didn't you love him?
Oh, he was great.
Yeah, and Marcus Constantine, and we're going to talk about this later on. One of the reasons why I wanted to bring this up in this challenge is because he eventually ended up being Caerdwen's mentor, her master.
Yeah, that's so, a cool tidbit.
Don't you love how these things kind of like wrap up and they kind of come full circle a little bit as you learn? Now, one thing I'd love to ask like Ken Gord or Donna Latow or Jillian Horvath, when they were creating these characters, did they have all of these outlined specifically?
Mm-hmm.
Because they can do this as the writing continues, but I just want to know if there was kind of like this flow chart, an org chart of immortals, such and such became master of such and such. And we're going to talk a little bit more about how cool this is later on. So good job, Mike.
Woohoo! Thumbs up.
Your very own immortal challenge that you absolutely crushed. So awesome, awesome, awesome. Well, I think that we are all kind of done here. The cup is dry, and I don't think that Joe's going to extend me any more of my credit because Kyle hasn't paid my bill yet. Thanks, Kyle. And so why don't we shovel and smuggle those disco fries, and maybe I'll see if Joe can like toss me half a bottle of something cool, and let's get out of here and get to the show.
Sounds like a plan.
All right, so here we are, Mike. We are at Chamoli's Choice, Take Back the Night, and this is part one of two. This is the retrospective. Now, Take Back the Night, this is season three, and this is episode 17. And one of the things that I found interesting about your choice is that your choice and Jill's choice and Vince's choice, all of these specific choices on these very particular episodes all revolve around season three. Do you find that strange? Do you find that's because season three is so darn good?
I think it's a very solid season for Highlander. I mean, like, if you go back to, like, I mean, especially since you guys did the Skip It episode, where you have, like, it's season one is definitely has some very low marks and high marks. Where by season two, it starts to kind of like even out. And then like by season three, it definitely starts ramping up and going in a vertical climb. And the quality and of the writing, the acting, you can tell the whole team, the ensemble of actors and creative people are just really gelling and hitting on all cylinders. And by the time they get to the fourth and fifth seasons, forget it.
You know, you and I always had this conversation when we were either playing the game or watching these episodes or calling each other like at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning. We always felt that season three was consistently the strongest, may not have like the highest peaks of the most, you know, powerful episodes, but easily the most consistent probably of all the seasons. And that's going to be a really hard season to do Seed or Skip It. I mean, season two had some great stuff, but season three, I mean, you know, page after page after page as you turn the pages of John Mosby's book, Fearful Symmetry, of which I'll be reading the excerpt of this episode soon, you're just like, wow, flip this page. So you have the lead up to Take Back the Night. You had Song of the Executioner, Star-Crossed, and Mythos. You had the Mythos trilogy. Then it goes into this. And even like and Testimony and Immortal Sins, you know, it's like bang, 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 you know.
I mean, they were, like I said, they were firing on all cylinders by the time they got that stretch, especially when they get into Paris, because I always find the Paris episodes to be a nice turn and like just a really solid bit of storytelling for the Highlander series.
Right. No, I totally agree. And that's how we felt when we're doing See It and Skip It. When Band of Brothers hit, and then we like transitioned over to Paris from Seacouver, there's something special. You and I always had this in agreement. There's something special about the European production. There was just something a little bit more Highlander about it, and it's kind of like a quality that you can't put your finger on, right?
Yeah, well, actually, I think part of it, for me at least, is I think one of the coolest things is like you have these, you know, like. Like I said, I'm a big, not only a big sword fan, but I like history too. So you get to see all these historical locations, and they always dug up a lot of neat history, like, you know, the Battle of Culloden and all these things. And they would, so there's things in castles or very, very, you know, ornate, architectured homes, like in Dwende and things like that. Or I'm trying to think the one with, Through a Glass Darkly, the one with his friend that's going like nuts.
Right, that was Dougray Scott.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a nice castle, and like that's when Mythos' girlfriend's like really sick. So there's just so many nice, you know, like storytelling and just all these great architectural things. Those courtyards for like the French mansions and things like that. It's just such beautiful architecture and it just adds to the history, because that's the problem with, you know, if you have like an immortal, like, you know, like immortal like Richie, because he's like, you know, compared to a Duncan, he's like 10 years old. Right. Compared to then when you start talking to like guys like Mythos who have been around for like 4,000 or 5,000 years, it's like that kind of history and world experience just really makes these characters so strong. That's why another reason why I like cared when she's been around such a long time. Because she's way older than Duncan is.
Right. So, yeah, so let's jump into this. So, Take Back the Night was written by Alan Swayze, and directed by Paolo Barsman. We like Paolo Barsman as a director in Highlander. I know that you and I are fans of his work.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed his work, and he does a lot of he's been executive producer on the Winona Earp TV series on Sci-Fi, which I enjoy.
And that's right.
And he's directed a bunch of episodes, as well as Dark Matter and a bunch of other sci-fi shows I enjoy. Like, he did a bunch of Lost Girl, too, which I enjoyed. That's another Canadian production.
Okay. Very cool. So I'm going to read something from our friend John Mosby's seminal work here for Highlander, and that is Fearful Symmetry, the essential guide for all things Highlander. And his excerpt on Take Back the Night reads as thus. Caerdwen, Kim Johnston Ulrich, and her mortal husband, Stephen, are having dinner in Paris and arguing over whether he should take a job in Madrid. When he goes to get the car so they can discuss everything more privately, Stephen is mugged and killed by a street gang. Caerdwen tries to intervene but is also gunned down for her troubles. Being an immortal, she'll live to fight another day with a warrior-like promise of vengeance that dates back to her as a Pict against the Romans in England around 60 AD. A younger member of the gang, not directly involved, happens to be stealing wallets at Richie's racetrack the following day. Duncan escorts him back to the city but senses another immortal nearby. It's Caerdwen, already starting to track down her quarry. Duncan has fought alongside her. She aided him when he rode with Bonnie Prince Charlie. And he appreciates her loss, but as one who has been through it himself, he warns her against traveling too far down the road of vengeance. But even if she can be dissuaded, perhaps the gang themselves may make that decision for her? As it turns out, Caerdwen has her own words of advice about the worth of trusting one's heart and taking risks. Also featuring Michael Modo as Maurice, Mark Edward Leon as Paolo, Ben Pollan as Bonnet Prince Charlie, Peter Semler as Callum. We remember that name, don't we, Mike?
Oh, yeah.
John Charles Martellier as Angus, and there are a lot of guest stars on here, but those were the primary guest stars, especially well, Maurice was in there, and then Paolo, and we'll talk about the child actor there a little bit. So there we go. That was the summation of Take Back the Night. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about here, and something that I always love bringing back to the forefront in the discussions of Highlander episodes, what about this episode makes this Highlander, to me personally, and maybe to you, Mike, but I think that this episode starts off very strongly setting up why this is a Highlander-type episode, because the discussion that Caerdwen and her husband, Stephen, are having at dinner, it's about a new opportunity for him. And he calls it an opportunity of a lifetime. And she's kind of like, there'll be other opportunities. You know, all of our friends are here. This is where we live. This is who we are. I don't really want to move. And he goes, well, this is something that's really important to me. And some of us don't live forever. And that kind of takes the conversation in a sour turn. What did you think about that? Did you think that they were trying to make a very fine point about her and Stephen being in this immortal relationship, like Duncan and Tessa?
Yeah, I think that was a definite point they were trying to drive home. And I think they did it really well, because it sets up a lot of great points that happen throughout the episode. I think one of the main driving points is that, Duncan had recently died in a couple episodes before. So he had to run to Paris to kind of and Lindsay had seen him die. So there was no getting around that. And he's still gun shy from Tessa dying, that he doesn't want to bring a mortal into the game, because they can so easily get caught up in the whirlwind of everything and lose their life. And unlike him and the other immortals, they're not going to bounce back from it. So, and I could see, that's the one thing with, you think, oh, I'm going to be an immortal. I'm going to live forever. That's fantastic. I can do all these great things. But the penalty there is you have to watch, even if you're lucky enough that it's old age, you have to watch your loved ones die. Mm-hmm. So, that's always a bitter pill to swallow as far as being an immortal. So that's, that's why Duncan's kind of hiding in Paris and just trying to get away from everything. And plus production wise, the show had to shift to fulfill the French obligation. So,
well, I mean, it's an interesting thing that you said about you know, it's the Immortals almost kind of take it for granted at times, because when you think about it, I mean, Caerdwen's at this time, like, what, 1,000 years old? Is that about how old she is?
Yeah, I think she died in 60 AD, so.
Yeah. So a little over 1,000 years old, right?
Actually,
you know, it's what's the math on that? I'm terrible at math. The show was
filmed in what? It was supposed to be like 1995, 6.
Right.
So she would have been almost 2,000 years old at this point.
2,000. I'm thinking of Amanda. Amanda was only 1,000 years old.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so, okay. So, give or take, you know, close. She's close to being a very ancient immortal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, around kind of like Ramirez-ish.
Right, yeah.
Right? So, when you live that long, perhaps something like this becomes a little cavalier. The attitude about it becomes like, oh, you know, whatever. You know, well, just tomorrow's tomorrow. Whatever.
You'll have other experiences.
Right. You know, and I think that definitely sets the tone for this episode. So I know that you loved Caerdwen a lot, which is why you chose this episode. And I know you love the collectible card game a lot. So there's something that I'd love for you to be able to tell our listeners, because when you and I are on episodes, we usually talk about the card game. And this is kind of like the perfect opportunity for you to talk about the immortal Caerdwen and why she's important to you, but also how this fits into your love of the collectible card game.
Well, Caerdwen, was it Arms and Tactics?
It was Arms and Tactics. It was the, let's see, it was the series edition, Watchers Chronicles, movie one, Arms and Tactics.
It was, it was the Arms and Tactics. So it was like the third TV expansion.
Yeah.
That came out, and like Caerdwen was one of the immortals along with some other great ones. And that's also when they introduced the swords. So you now can play the weapons of choice as well, which is a great addition to the game. And she uses in the show, she uses like a short sword of Roman gladius. So like that's pretty. And like, so whenever I would design a deck with the weapons of choice stuff, I'd always pick that sword for her. And like, she was just a great character. I mean, she had a great ability. Unfortunately, I could never, back when we were playing tournaments then, I could never really get the rhythm down for her to make her really kick butt in a tournament the way I wanted it to.
But thematically, she was about the support of her allies.
Yeah, like her clan members were her strong point. For every clan member she had out, her allies, like Jacob and Neva,
Callum,
they would, if she had those cards in play, they would do different things that helped her, like prevent certain kinds of attacks or be able to defend certain things in a different way. And also, for every ally she had in play, she could make an additional attack. I think the problem I had with her at the time was that like they didn't have like any kind of like edge card or support card that would allow her to put out like two allies at a time. That would have made her a much more powerful. Because you had to let everything build in Highlander. If you don't have the time, you wind up losing your head.
I think that when they designed her, I think they were really like firing on all cylinders as well, because they designed her as an immortal well, but they also designed a lot of her support cards well, because she was about the people that surrounded her, that loved her, that supported her, and once those people were gone, she made you pay for that.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah, there's that card Retribution, where if an ally leaves play, if you play that card, was it like a 4-point direct damage card?
Yeah, I think you got the. I'm trying to remember. I think I have the bind.
But it was pretty major, though. You know,
yeah,
it was big.
It was, yeah, big. It wasn't just like a little slap on the wrist. It was like big time.
Yeah, so I know that's when I think for us, like kind of like third season, when that set came out. Our fever pitch for like the Highlander card game was like at an all-time high, but
right.
At the same time, though, like it was kind of it was lockstep with what was going on with the series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely like had a lot of. It says if you play this card if your opponent removed one of your allies from play during his last turn, that's 3 damage.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah, it's like take them because I'm going to use this on you. And it was restricted to 4, so like, I mean that's 12 points of damage if you use all 4 of them.
Yeah, if they don't have a strategy against that. So that's, I know that was really important to you and one of the reasons why you wanted to choose this episode. But let's take a look at, aside from Caerdwen herself, and I think they did a great job at kind of establishing her as a character and the thrust of her character, but no more so than when they showed the first flashback. And I love the flashbacks in this episode. The flashbacks were so good. And like you said, when you saw Caerdwen, one of the first things that she did was she like pulled out the gladius and she used that as a weapon. And it was very particular at the time. You know, she was, her first mentor was Marcus Constantine, a Roman general. And it's just, when we see Highlander, we love it when it goes back this far because it's so steeped in like big, 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 like earth-changing history, right?
Oh, definitely.
There's a little bit of a history that I found on the internet of her. She was a warrior who fought against the Romans in 60 AD. That's when she died fighting the Romans. And then Marcus constantly found her and taught her about immortality. And then, you know, she served her people. So here's a funny thing. So in 1255, you know, many years later, centuries later, millennia later, her first pupil, her first pupil was Alex Raven. And Alex Raven was, in my opinion, in Kevin's opinion, was like our top candidate for maybe taking the Raven before the Raven spinoff before they announced Elizabeth Grayson, because we really liked her as a character. And Alex Raven, you know, had this whole Celtic vibe to her. And then, you know, millennia later, Matthew McCormick became her student, Matthew of Salisbury, and then he became the teacher of Carl Robinson. So I love it how these things kind of start coming full circle with like mentor to teacher to mentor to teacher, and then some of the ones that we start liking.
Yeah, it's really neat too if you think about it, how like, you know, immortals of a certain kind of personality, how they pick their students.
You mean like the Rebecca did with she did so with Amanda, not so much with Luther, right?
Right. Well, I mean, like, I think she probably saw things in Luther, Rebecca, that, like, you know, it's like, you know, like you have a kid, you know, they just need some love, a good hug, and maybe they'll turn around and be a good person.
And until you dangle a crystal of immortality in front of their face.
And then forget it.
The Methuselah is done, yeah, and then it's all downhill from there.
But, I mean, another thing that was really neat, they mentioned in the episode, and it's on the back of her persona, that she was fighting for Boudica, like her tribe.
Okay.
Who's like a famous like female warrior, like the whole painting of the face kind of thing, like you see in Braveheart. Mm-hmm. I think that comes from like the Boudica's main, you know, her time of like fighting the Romans, and she did some amazing. And she was like just a housewife. But they butchered her family, and like she rose to be this great warrior, like leader. But she kicked the crap out of those guys. So I mean, it just, and I'm always watching the History Channel, and like I saw a really good documentary thing on her a year ago that was amazing. So it's just really neat how they bring all this great history in. So like a strong female warrior general who led her like the Scots and the Celts to like, you know, take on the Romans. So that's a really neat, and then you got a strong character out of Caerdwen who, you know, she does her thing and like is out there kicking butt too.
Sure, it would be nice to see a movie about that, a la Braveheart, you know?
Yeah.
So one of the things probably the last flashback that we saw was when Duncan was escorting Bonnie Prince Charlie after the Battle of Culloden to safekeeping and hiding. And that's when we saw Caerdwen in a little bit more of a modern time. She had a different alias, and she kind of insults Bonnie Prince Charlie.
Yeah, that was
it was kind of funny, right? Because he didn't see her under the rags, and or him under the rags. And there's a scene there towards the end when they finally situate Charlie and they get him into like kind of like the disguise. But one of the things that really struck me, and I don't really piece these together as quickly as I'd like, but there's a scene when he takes his leave of Bonnie Prince Charlie and says that I'm going to make those English bastards pay for the crimes that they're doing against farmers and against farmers' families and children, you know, like people who've never picked up a sword or have never gotten into battle, because the English were pretty much wiping out the countryside. They're going on their skirmishes, pretty much suppressing any uprising that would happen after the battle. And then I watched that. I'm like, oh my gosh, this ties directly into what Stephen Keen was making a point about in Forgive Us Our Trespasses. Now, Take Back the Night's in season 3, but Forgive Us Our Trespasses is in season 5. And this is where Keen really gets into Duncan's head mentally and says, you're a murderer. You murdered innocent people, and you're hiding that or trying to disguise that as revenge. And that's where Duncan was kind of like, I really am a murderer. And Mythos was like, no, you pretty much were right. You're just kind of falling into his line of logic right now, hook, line, and sinker, because you're depressed or whatever. You know, you've been through a lot, but
because you're a Boy Scout.
Yeah, you're testing your faith. Your faith is being tested right now, but believe me, at the time you were in the right. That's what Mythos was trying to basically tell him. But I thought that was kind of neat that if you want to watch Forgive Us Our Trespasses, it's a soft sequel to Take Back the Night, in my opinion. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I'd agree with you there. I mean, they always did a really nice job of, like, you know, like we touched on this piece of history here, and like we're gonna use it again like a year or two down the road, and like just, you know, make everything wrap up, and like I guess it saves them money on footage too.
Well, it did use some of the flashback stuff.
Yeah, from that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it does save on the production sense for sure.
Yeah, but at the same time, was it Horvath who was doing that, did all the that was maintaining the Bible?
I think so. Yeah,
because I remember she wrote a book that it was like the Watcher Chronicle.
Maureen Russell wrote that.
Book. Oh, Maureen Russell wrote that one.
Yeah, yeah, but I'm sure that
I think she was probably talking to Horvath.
They were all kind of like together and making sure. I mean, I don't think that Highlander itself had the strictest Bible in the world. I mean, not like, say, today's TV shows, because today's TV shows, everything's operating off of this very serialized format from one episode to another episode to another episode. You know, this show was a little bit, I think, looser than that at the time. I mean, this was like the mid to late 90s.
Well, plus
95, I think it was.
Yeah, 95, 96. Or this was this 97?
This is the third season, so 92, 93, 94, 95.
Yeah, 94, yeah, it's probably been in that run. But, I mean, you think about it, too. It's like they had to go to the library for the most part and do their research. They could. It's not like they were, whipping out their cell phone. Oh, Google blah, 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 or, you know,
right?
Wikipedia this. It's like they're sitting there with, you know, stacks of books and reading through stuff, and they couldn't keep, like a you know, Excel sheet with all of the things like lined up like they do now. So like those people did some very serious work there.
I know scripting continuity coordinators at the time must have had their hands full big time.
And I think she wrote some episodes too, like Horvath. So.
Well, after, you know, touching on these flashbacks, which is, I think these are some of the best flashbacks, like, in the series, because we love it when it goes back to Scotland. But bringing it back to kind of, like, modern time, one of the things that, Mike, and you did a great job with these notes, one of the things that I think is really, really important is the aftermath of what happened to Caerdwen's husband, but how that ties into Duncan's decision to whether or not he's going to open himself up to Anne Lindsay. Yeah, that's a big thing. That's a big thing, because is he going to risk hurting himself again, or, as we'll see in a couple episodes in Mortal Sins, which are a couple episodes after this, putting whoever he falls in love with, Anne Lindsay, at risk?
Yeah, I mean that's a point, because I mean he's still mourning the loss of Tessa from, like, you know, the second season. So like he just, I mean, I really get the impression, like, listening to the, because there's a nice scene where Caerdwen and him are sharing a bottle of wine in front of a fire. It looks kind of romantic, and you're like, oh no, Duncan's going to do the Duncan thing.
He's Duncan not quite anything.
Yeah.
A bottle of scotch or
it's like, uh-oh. Whiskey. But I mean, like, but I guess like for her, like nothing really happened, which was nice because it would have been really cheap in the relationship of her marriage. So, but you know, like Duncan doesn't want to like, he's expressing that like, yes, you know, I've had someone, she died for like, you know, for like pennies in a car. Yeah. And like, you know, and that still tears him up. That's why he doesn't want to bring in Anne to like the game, because he's afraid like that she could be collateral damage just like Tessa was. And during that conversation, Caradwell makes a great point. Well, they're adults. They're not children, so they can make their own decisions, like give her the opportunity. And Duncan's kind of like, he's still like, you know, you can see him hemming and hawing about that one, but it definitely, by the course of the episode, it works through, and he winds up sending a plane ticket to Joe to give to Anne, and like makes a call at the end of the episode. It was a really kind of sweet scene.
Great scene. Yeah.
I was never the biggest Anne Lindsay fan, because I mean, she was a very attractive woman, so it wasn't like, you know, I didn't think she was attractive or something, or not good enough for Duncan, but it was just, there was just something that always kind of bugged me about her. And maybe it was just like, you know, like I like Tessa, and like, so like how like a lot of people were like at the time, like she just didn't really stand a chance, because she had to be the rebound person.
Now, and that's a fair point, because, you know, we talk about that a lot with other fans on the forum. Is why is it that Anne never really had the opportunity to ingrain herself with the fans, ingrain herself in the show? And Kevin and I talked about that at length in Shadows. But I think it's still because a lot of us, we wholesale fell in love with the Duncan and Tessa relationship.
Mm-hmm.
From like, obviously from episode one, because that's just the way he looked at her. And when I say he, both Duncan and Adrian, the way that he looked at her as an actor in the character, the way they were together. And even though they didn't have like the best written scenes together, they made it work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Their relationship was very tangible and real.
Yeah. You could really feel it. And I think like when you get to the episode of The Darkness, when like she dies, mm-hmm. It just kind of like, you know, you could feel the pain for Duncan. I mean, like Adrian acted that so well. You really felt his pain. And I mean, cause he lost like Tessa and technically Richie, mm-hmm. but I mean, he knew Richie was going to bounce back, but it just, so like, I think us as the viewers being there and watching that go down, it really like ripped our hearts out too. So like, because we really liked the couple together. So it's understandable why, you know, Anne didn't really, it's like, she's the rebound. Like she just wasn't really going to be able to like fill those shoes from an acting standpoint, or I guess a character standpoint. But I mean, I think the actress herself was great as Anne.
But I think that because the way that she was written, and because, like you said, it's like, you know, she was kind of the rebound relationship. I don't think that they wrote her in the best way for Duncan to be able to say, you know what, I'm going to take that chance. You know, I don't think they really gave Anne a chance.
Yeah, I don't think they ever intended on her being there for more than like a season or so, because it was one of those things where if he were to fall in love that quick after Tessa, I think a lot of the, because I mean, like, you know as well as I do, back in the day when Highlander was on, it was a very strong female audience for the show.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, like, most of the conventions we went to were like, you know, there were so many
10 to 1, 15 to 1.
Yeah.
Women to men. Women,
yeah.
Yeah.
So it was like, I think like there would have been like a massive revolt.
You know, it's funny because if it really depends on if you fall in the debate of whether or not they wrote her correctly, or whether or not she just didn't chemistry-wise work with Adrian. I think she worked chemistry-wise with Adrian. I just don't think that they gave her the opportunity to become a fully realized character on the show. You know, and
yeah,
they didn't give the audience the chance to make that decision as the audience. You know,
right.
they were like the. It's kind of like the die was cast against her already, as soon as she came on the scene.
Yeah, like I said, that they definitely didn't. I don't think they wrote her in a fashion that would allow her to be like as loved and adored as Tessa was.
Yeah,
I think they kind of had that in their mind. I don't know because I wasn't in the writer's room, but my guess would be that they didn't really intend to have her be the new love of his life kind of thing, even though, like, you know, Adrian did love her. Mm-hmm. And because he did a lot of really nice gestures to her, especially, like, you know, later on in the season. But it was the house, yeah. That he lifts off the ground.
Right.
That was always one
for another show.
That's another show. Yeah. That was a very good episode too, though. Because of the villain.
You know what though? I mean, like we discussed. I mean, Kevin and I discussed Anne at length here, and I think you bring up really good points. But one of the things I wanted to get to before I lose track of this is that as good as Anne's story is, and it continues in testimony, I think that something that gets glossed over a lot in this episode is what Richie does in this episode.
Yeah, Rich, the beast B or C storyline in this was a very great one for Richie. Real a lot of character mm-hmm. development. Mm-hmm.
What do you think about his choices? I mean, like, you know, Duncan keeps saying that, and we're gonna tackle this in the commentary, but. You know, Richie is in this big biking circuit. That's his thing now. This is kind of like it's what drives him. It gives him purpose.
Well, he plays third in Long Beach.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it's the whole thrust of I have this rival. His name is Basil. And if I just push myself a little harder and risk just a little bit more that humans can't do, I can get the better of this guy. And it's something that Duncan kind of calls him on. And all this ends up basically pushing Richie to a point where whether or not he thought he did or whether or not he was conscious about it, but it ended up killing him up to a point, but definitely killed Basil. And it was an interesting turn for Richie. What'd you think of that whole outcome of what happened?
I thought it, I mean, like, they definitely made Basil into a, I guess, quote unquote villain because he was not a nice guy. Not saying it deserved to die.
Was this kind of like Highlander meets Rush?
Right.
That the movie with, about those two, the two race car drivers pushing each other?
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was you know, at the same time, and like Richie's like an immortal who, I mean, he's only been an immortal for what, a year or two at this point? Or like less, like a year.
Yeah, about a year.
Mm-hmm. And so, and like age wise, he's 18, right? 19?
Younger, I
think. Younger, 17? He's like 17, 18.
He's like 17, yeah.
So, I mean, like he still has the maturity level of a young kid. So, like, I mean, and when you're 17, 18 years old, you kind of think you're immortal in it anyway.
Right.
And that you know everything, too. So, like, when Duncan's laying down the logic of a dad or a more experienced person, I think Richie's natural tendency is just go, oh, whatever, man. Just, you know, cool your jets. I got this.
What do you know?
Yeah, what do you know? You've only been around for 400 years.
Yeah, right. You don't know me.
You don't know my pain.
Yeah, but he killed somebody.
Right, I mean, like...
Or caused somebody to be killed.
Right, I think the other guy was pushing against him, too. So I don't think Richie's in the clear on this one, but I don't think he did what he feels guilty about. Because the guy was trying to run Richie off the road, and in the course of that, they both went down.
Right.
So, I mean, if this guy wasn't trying to be that big of a bleep bleep... You know, I mean, like, he would still be alive. Richie wouldn't have crashed either. And they would have actually had to, like, you know, prove it in pure skill and finish the race and see who wins.
Okay. No, I see that. And you're right. If Richie weren't immortal and this guy was doing what... If Basil was doing what he was doing, he could have ended up killing an innocent man.
Right.
You know, so it could have been easily on Basil's fault. But Richie kind of also, he bit the bait pretty hard.
Oh, yeah. And, that goes back to the maturity of being like a 17, 18-year-old kid, so.
Yeah. He was all, you know, his blood was up.
Because you're immortal year one at that point.
No, true enough. True enough. So, but you know what? When it comes to kind of like Richie storytelling, I thought that something like this had great consequence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like, oh gosh darn, I did so and so, and you know, I didn't get the girl, or I can't speak French, or you know, it's just all that stuff was very cosmetic when it came to his character development. But something like this is big time.
Yeah, I mean, and like one of my other favorite episodes with Richie is season two, towards the end of the season, the Prodigal Son with Martin Hyde.
Martin Hyde's another one of your favorites.
Yeah, he's another one of my favorites. But it was just a really great development thing for Richie, because, and that was a great storyline for Duncan too, because you got to see that he was, you know, being hunted by Hyde and all that stuff. So that, a lot of character development for Richie in that one, and Duncan as well. So when you see it kind of come forward more in this episode, it's a great storyline for Richie that ran a few episodes. Mm-hmm. And now, like, of course, like, Richie dies. So Richie got to climb out of the morgue and run naked through the city scene.
It was kind of funny. I'm glad they added a little bit of that levity to the scene.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. Yeah.
Because I guess that's every immortal is like, you know. And like, Duncan didn't go to pick him up or wait for him either. He just let him. It's like, because Duncan was kind of pissed at him because he's trying to prove a point that, like, you can't, your actions have consequences. And just because you're going to live doesn't mean everybody else is going to. So I think that's why he purposely didn't like go and, you know, hang out in an alley by the morgue so he could, with a pair of jeans, like, here, take these.
Well, it's kind of like a big brother or fatherly one. It's like, you think you know everything? Get yourself out of it.
Right. It's a rite of passage.
Yeah, go ahead, tough guy. If you don't want to listen to me, you don't need my help.
You're going to have to walk naked through the streets of Paris.
which kind of funny. It goes all the way back to, like, the episode... was it Shadows and Light or Studies in Light, where Gregor died? He was killed by a vengeful gunman. And then Duncan says, you have to disappear. You got to leave.
Mm-hmm.
This entire life that you built for yourself is gone. And that's what he basically told Richie. He's like, this entire life that you build for yourself here in Paris is done.
It's like you can't come back for like a generation or two.
Yeah. Which, or else people will notice.
He was back like, what, the next year?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's... It was the right thing to say at the time.
Yeah. Lesson learned.
Right. So one of the things that I thought that was really nice of you to say here, and I know that you love Caradwyn as a character, is that you would have liked to have seen her character come back to the show. One of the few immortals to live at the end of the episode, and one of the few female characters Duncan didn't sleep with. He's no Kirk, and I know that you're saying that's reference to James Tiberius Kirk, of which he did not have the kind of relationship that the people have built the legend over. He really hasn't. But I digress, because I love Star
Trek.
Okay,
I'm not going to bring up the Green Girl then.
Who?
Kirk.
Well, he didn't sleep with Marta. Marta tried to seduce him, but he didn't sleep with her.
He would have. That's a different podcast.
Okay, that's a different podcast. But like you said, though, you're right. Caradwyn's still alive in the universe that we know. She didn't become the trope of Highlander, where Duncan's like, I'm sad, I need comfort, here's the female immortal, and they end up together, like Annie Devlin was with him.
But right.
Those circumstances were a little bit more extreme.
Well, that was also a very mutual kind of, because she had just lost her fella.
Right.
And
Duncan is a little bit past that point. Not past Tessa, but past that point of rawness.
Right.
Right. But so, you're right. Caradwyn.
I would have loved to have seen her
come
back.
She had so much potential. Yeah, right. I'm sorry, Mike. Go ahead. Yeah.
I would have loved to have seen her come back. Because, I mean, like, just think about it. Like, we were just talking about Marcus Constantine, whose character I really enjoyed, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been neat to, like, you know, find a storyline where you could bring the two of them back and maybe do the whole immortal teacher thing, you know? That would have been kind of a neat storyline to have in a flashback or a forward scene. Because Constantine was still alive too, right?
Yeah, because Nefertiti did not kill him. Duncan killed Nefertiti.
So. Right. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, that would have been just like, I mean, a neat storyline to like kind of bring up over the next couple seasons.
Well, I mean, you have Caradwyn out there, and she has such rich history, and she's she was the right combination of everything for a female immortal. You know, she had the history, she had the
she could have been the Raven
development. Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. I'm like, do you think that she would have been a good candidate at that time? I mean, Alex Raven kind of was dancing around the same kind of character persona,
right,
if you will. But do you think that if they really looked into the archives of their characters, do you think that, like, Bill Panzer and Peter Davis, when they were producing at the time, and do you think that would have taken Caradwyn as a serious consideration for a character? I mean, why do you think that she wasn't considered? I mean, she's still out there, and I think that she had the right amount of immortal experience. She had the age. She had the right look. And even if it wasn't the same actress, it could have been a persona, the character persona that you could move forward with. So
right.
There's a lot there that they could have built on, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. I think, like, I think they just had a certain thing they were going for at the time, and I think it's one of those things where, like, you got too many chefs in the kitchen. Like, they wanted Amanda, I think, initially to be the spinoff, and I think for whatever reason USA wasn't, like, on board with Amanda being the spinoff at first, and it seemed like, so then it's like, because a lot of those, the season six stuff is more of like, it's like a cattle call for, like, you know, the Highlander spinoff. So they kept having, like, a lot of different actresses and trying different.
Yeah. A lot of tryouts for sure.
It was definitely a very tryout driven season after they had wrapped up a couple storylines. So, I mean, I could definitely could have seen, like, you know, even the actress recasting, the actress that played Alex Raven being Caradwyn.
Would that have blown your mind? Would you have been like, yeah, I can accept this?
Again, she was a very, very attractive redhead. So, I mean, like, so they definitely had a thing for casting redheads on that show.
Well, I mean, do you think, well, I mean, so the actress Dara Tomanovich, who played Alex Raven, would you have been like, okay, if she came on the scene with the pulled back hair and the bun and the Celtic markings, the Pict markings, and all of a sudden she walked on, and then they said, you know, this is Caradwyn, but she took on this new alias,
mm-hmm,
maybe as Alex Raven. Would you have been okay with that?
If it was written well enough and acted well enough, I would have been down with it.
Okay.
I mean, there might have been a little bit of a, like, at first, just because, like,
rawr, rawr.
It's like you took away my girl.
Yeah.
But
so what makes Caradwyn stand out, say, over any of the other, like, stronger female immortals? You know, like, say, like Amanda or an Alex Raven or you know, Kyra, or, you know, it's what is it about her specifically? Because I know that you said that you're a fan of history and you're a fan of swords and you're a fan of these time periods and the flashbacks are great and blah blah blah, but what is it about her? Was it the actress as well?
I liked the actress. I thought she was great in the role, and I liked her in the you know, as the modern one. And we were talking about the flashbacks. I think the flashbacks were just huge for me in this episode. She just seemed like a very solid, real character to me. She didn't seem like, oh, okay, this is the immortal chick of the week kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
She there was a lot of meat and potatoes there. It wasn't just like, you know, like, finger food or anything. It was really solid to me. It just sink your teeth into it. And that was the problem I had with some of the immortal actresses when they were doing the season six stuff with all of the the tryouts. It's like, not all of those characters really appealed to me.
When we were watching this live, because you and I, Kevin watched it on DVD, and that's one thing that he admitted to me. He says he never really watched it, and it's not his fault, because the LA market wasn't a large market. As a matter of fact, we talked about this on an episode.
I think it was the last one.
Yeah, the LA on episode 44, the LA market was a market that was, like, just not existent for Highlander, and not having that market, you know, you don't get a lot of it's obviously, like, market saturation. So we saw it every single weekend, and we called each other at, like, midnight or 1 o'clock. Were you always anticipating Caradwyn's return at the time when we were watching it live?
I guess probably secretly down.
Or yeah. Wanting to have her back?
I wanted to have her back at the time.
Yeah.
But like at that time, with the exception of Amanda, they didn't have a lot of reoccurring like immortals too much. I mean, besides like you had your crew of guys like Mythos and usually too.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah.
The other one that recurred a lot, but he had already been offed, was Xavier with Roland.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like that was, you didn't always have a lot of like reoccurring. So I think she would have been a great, like not regular, but maybe a once or twice a season kind of like, and another one that was fun to see come back every so often was Sean Burns.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, you get a little taste, a little wisdom. And she definitely, you know, as this episode plays out, she was a big voice of reason for Duncan there. So like that, and again, she's like, what, 1,500 years roughly older than him? Mm-hmm. 13, 14?
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, that's a wise person to talk to. I mean, he wound up having, you know, Mythos, who's like twice her age or almost three times. So,
yeah, she's also coming from like a female perspective. She has a completely different like nature versus nurture kind of mentality.
Right.
You know, but hold that thought because we're going to get to that thought in just a little bit. One of the things I wanted to get to, because not everything about this episode clicked for you. A lot of it did, but there was one thing that you made a specific point of that you wanted to talk about regarding, I think, one of the primary characters of the show. It just didn't quite work for you.
Yeah, I mean, I my notes I have written here, it's like, I love this episode, but there are a few nits to pick. And one of the weakest, the one character in the episode is this young kid, Paulo, who's a pickpocket at the track and then he's the tie-in from like the Richie storyline to the Cadwin storyline. Mm-hmm. And it's a good character or a decent character, but the actor is, I mean, it's been years, so hopefully he became a better actor, but it's like Mark Edward Leon as mm-hmm. Paulo. Unlike Mortal Sins, like the little kid in Mortal Sins, I thought was just a fantastic little Bernard was a fantastic little actor.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, like, and I know, like, you know, like the one thing that always bugged me though is like, did it seem like Paulo's dialogue was dubbed to you?
Well, they did. I mean, that's notorious for what they did with French actors over there. They dubbed American right. actors over French actors.
So I mean, like, dubbed. I didn't really like the look of the kid either too much. He seemed kind of like slimy.
Yeah, I think they were trying to go for maybe kind of like the whole Artful Dodger kind of flavor.
Right, yeah.
It just missed the mark.
Yeah, I think, but I mean, the dubbing, the whole dubbing thing, I think, is the thing that bugged me the most. It just seemed like that's not the tone was so light, like whoever they got to dub it, his voice was so high and squeaky.
I just don't know why they would let people like have their own accents, you know? I don't think that would have been an issue at all.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't bother me. I mean, like, I watch a lot of, like, BBC, so accents don't bother me much. I mean, at some point I'll figure it out.
Yeah, it's strange the way that the choices are made for the markets because, you know, this is going to get shown to a predominantly U.S. market. I could be completely speaking out of turn, but maybe they're just like, you know what? If it's our U.S. market's larger than our European market, even though we have European partners with Reicher and Gaumont, we still have to make sure that our U.S. market's taken care of. And,
right.
You know, like Inspector LeBrun, they dubbed all over his part. And I was like, you can tell too, you know, because it just doesn't sync up. You can feel when it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. I mean, I like the Paulo character. Obviously, he was the catalyst to that brought two different storylines together. But unlike Little Bernard, he didn't really quite rise to the occasion as an actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and I'm guessing maybe it was like one of his first roles or an maybe. Early role in his career, and maybe he got better. I did an IMDb him to see how long he went on as an actor.
Maybe. But at the same time, though, it's like, you know, as productions go, you have X amount of budget, you need to get an actor, maybe fans would forgive him, and sometimes maybe producers like maybe Bill was saying like, you know what, they'll be okay with him. You know, it'll be all right. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
Yeah, but one of the last things that you wanted to talk about was after coming off of what we call the Mythos trilogy. Okay, it's not technically a trilogy, but we call it a trilogy, which would be Song of the Executioner, Star-Crossed, and then Mythos itself. This is when Kallus was chasing Mythos, and then you had the death of Hugh Fitzcairn, and then finally Duncan tracking down Mythos, and then having Kallus jailed, which comes to fruition in Finale 1-2 at the end of Season 3, which we're in. You felt that this episode was a tough act to follow when it came to following the Mythos trilogy.
Well, like I said, it's one of my favorite episodes because I like the characters. I think the acting, the production values, all that stuff were rock solid. I think in the direction and everything. I think it suffers from the bar had been set so high. Because in a 22 episodes of TV, I remember at one of the conventions we went to, Bill Panzer said, he goes, you guys watch the reruns as much, the ratings for the reruns were as much as they were for like the new episodes. So that's why they cut down the seasons to 20 episodes a year.
Right.
And because it saved them like, you know, a couple million dollars every year by not having to shoot two episodes. So I'm like, you know, I can understand that. So, I mean, not every one of those things is – not every episode can be, like, you know, the Mythos and the Star-Crossed and all that stuff. You know, there's got to be peaks and valleys as you're writing. And because if everything's on a high, you really can't appreciate anything. So when things come down a little bit and give you a chance to breathe, it's like when you watch a good horror movie. You got to have that long walk down the hallway in order to, like – so when the thing comes jumping out at you, you go, and you fly out of the seat.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a pacing issue. But, I mean, I think this is a very strong episode. I definitely wouldn't say skip it.
No.
And, but, you know, is it falling behind those, you know, the introduction of Mythos, the death of Fitzcairn, the death of Duncan and Song of the Executioner. And Kallus is one of my easily top, you know, nemesis for Duncan throughout the series. I mean, you had some really good ones. I mean, you got like your Xavier, your Horton. And I you know, Kallus is definitely up there. Cause I mean, especially since in this season, they kept, you know, giving you, you know, he's back there and like, just like his methodology of like getting under Duncan's skin was just so fantastic. And
as
like,
as far as I know, he's the only immortal that's appeared as that same character 5 times.
Right.
Right, you had Song of the Executioner, you had Star-Crossed, you had Mythos, you had Finale 1 and 2.
Right.
So he's the only immortal that's appeared as his character, David Robb, as Kallus, that many times. I mean, you've had Xavier. Well, hold on a second. Xavier had Forgive Us Our Trespasses.
Mm-hmm.
Forgive Us Our Trespasses. For Tomorrow We Die.
For Tomorrow We Die.
Unholy Alliance 1 and 2. He was in Finale Part 1. And he was in the one with Morgan Destang, the one with
Hamza Al-Khazir.
No, that was the first. That was Finale Part 1. That was with Hamza. It was the very beginning of the episode. But then there was a one where he had his doppelganger, the guy that did the same kind of crimes with him with the poison gas.
Right.
I think he was in flashback there. So, interesting. I think they're neck and neck.
Yeah. That is pretty cool. I mean, just like, you know, in a series like this where, like, the confrontation between, like, the protagonist and antagonist is going to be a very, you know, defined thing, mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to have, like, you know, reoccurring, like, you know, villains. It's not like you're going to get Moriarty coming, like, you know, he's, like, the big mainstay for, like, or the Red Skull with Captain America, like they're always going to come back. Somewhere they're going to be reborn, or whatever. Can't quite do that with the Immortals.
You know, I don't mind though, and this is something for a different show, and it's something I'd love to tackle. Is I don't mind having one Immortal strung out over the course of several shows because not every single Immortal that Duncan's going to run into is going to get whacked.
Right.
You know, too. Some are going to be better.
I mean, that was, they established that really nicely with Xavier in the beginning. Xavier was definitely a tactician. Mm-hmm. And Kallus was this, very similar. Like, he's a very patient, methodical man. Look what he did to lure Paul out of the monastery.
Right, right.
I mean, that's some serious planning there. That's not just like implanting drugs in Joe's bar to like to frame Joe. And like he attacks all your friends. You know, he did the thing with Anne and the prescriptions and stuff.
Forged her signature.
Forged her signature, and like
right.
So like all of these little details make it so that you can really screw with the guy's head before like you're gonna go in there and then like start whacking at him with a sword. So like if his head's not in the game, then there's a chance he's gonna slip up. I mean this is like off topic from our episode here, but like I was watching Starcrossed again, and I wish Fitz had done a little better in the fight.
Yeah, well, so do we all.
I mean, not that better, but I wish it had been more of a you know, give and take, you know, back and forth before, like, because it seemed like it fits. But then again, he just swam like a couple hundred yards.
Yeah, exactly. I also never kind of like qualified Fitz as being a great swordsman. That's not who he was.
Right.
I don't think, but I could be wrong. So before we get way too off topic, which is those are great points for another show. one of the things I wanted to ask you before we start wrapping things up in our final thoughts, something that always happens on our page on Blood of Kings. Some of the fans there ask similar questions to what I want to ask you about Duncan being somewhat of either too much of a Boy Scout or a little bit of a hypocrite about his attitudes towards things as an immortal, because I think sometimes he's written a little inconsistently. Because in one turn he's like, this is what needs to be done, but in the same turn, if it's somebody else does it, he'll chastise them about it.
Yeah.
So what I want to ask you is, do you think in the final analysis of this episode, do you think when Duncan said, like, you know, violence isn't the answer, do you think that in many ways he was being hypocritical towards Caerduin at this time? He's saying that revenge solves nothing, but he's exacted revenge in his lifetime. And do you think maybe he's compensating for the fact that he's starting to feel that the deaths that are on his hands are starting to weigh on his conscience now?
I would say, like, Duncan, throughout the course of the series, has always been a little hypocritical on the, you know, like, well, I mean, his upbringing as being the clan's, the chieftain's son, and like, you know, inheriting that thing where you have to kind of look after everybody, his whole justice for all kind of thing, I think has kind of like bounced back and forth over the series. But in this episode, the one thing that was, I think, is really nice is that at one point, Caerduin's telling him, there's been enough bloodshed. You don't need to do this. And he's like, but they're killing women and children, and, you know, children and women in the mother's arms and all that kind of stuff. So his you know, his social justice warrior thing kicks into overdrive, and he's got to go off and, like, you know, and even when she finds him and like, you know, patch up his clothing and you know, gives him a bed to sleep in, he starts questioning what he was doing, all that he had done right there. So, like, you know, it's nice how, like, in the writing, how, like, you know, she's out for her vengeance at different times. And, like, you know, she's learned through her experiences that, like, you know, well, it's not always black and white and cut and dry. So, like, you know, and she's trying to, bestow that information onto Duncan at times. And, like, he didn't want to listen. So it was kind of neat how, like, when he's throwing the lesson that he learned from her back at her to remind her, because, like, she's definitely like in overdrive, because, you know, it's everything's very raw. Her husband was just murdered. She loved this guy. So, like, it's, I think it's one of those things that, like, yes, he can be hypocritical, but at this point, like this, they did a nice job of like weaving these, you know, like the hypocrisy in and out of the thing. So like, he doesn't come off quite as hypocritical as he's been in other episodes. So I
think that you're right about that. I think that it's easy to find an episode and bear down on it and say like, oh, he's being inconsistent. I don't think he's being inconsistent. I think that when you live as long as these immortals have lived, they're going to eventually flip their opinion. You know, I think that at one point in time, Mythos believed one way, and then 1,000 years later, he believed another way. 1,000 years later, he's back to where he was, and 1,000 years later, he's back to where he was. You know, so
I mean, Mythos is a great example for that, for what you just said, because here you got a guy who was one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. You know, you've watched civilizations rise and fall. Mm-hmm. So, and for him, like several times. So it's like all those things, all those life experiences are going to change you. So like, you know, like Cadman started off very vengeful, like after her, when she woke up from her first death, and like she, the guy that had apparently just killed her friend Neva, she like practically took his head off with her gladius. So it was like,
oh yeah, she was wrecking people.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, so she and herself, like over a few hundred years of life experiences, has determined that, like, okay, well, I can't go out and revenge everything. So like, we just gotta like, you know, learn from these lessons. And sometimes like, yes, sometimes you just want to run up and smack someone in the mouth, but you know, you have to let your head sink in and go, okay, this isn't the right response for this.
Right.
So
sometimes seasoning prevents you from doing stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, or age or experience or whatever. So here's a tough question, Mike.
Okay.
Because we actually have her as part of the quickening scale. This is Kevin's immortal quickening scale, with one being Katana or Richie's jacket, two being Michael Christian or Duncan's Thunderbird, three being the immortal Chimoli or the Iron Pipe, four being Canis and Anthony Galen, five being Luther and Hufitz Cairn, six being Xavier and Amanda, seven, Connor and Kurgan, eight, Duncan and Caradwyn, 9, Darius, 10, Mythos, and all 4 horsemen. How would you rate this episode? Where would you rate this episode on Kevin's immortal quickening scale?
On Kevin's immortal quickening scale, I would say I would give it... I would say 8 for Duncan and Caradwyn, just because it's Caradwyn. But actually, I think I would go to 9 for, yeah, and say Darius.
That's a high rating.
I think it's one of the strongest episodes in the franchise. It might not be the high, you know, high bar.
Well, that's you. I mean, this is your rating,
right,
on Kevin's scale. So,
but I would definitely go a notch above the 8 to a 9, because I like it that much. Or if you could make it Duncan, Caradwyn, Kenny, so it's 8.5.
Kenny. I like where your head's at with the episode. I think the episode's a fantastic episode. It tackles a lot of what I love about Highlander. From a production standpoint, I love the flashbacks, and I love how it ties in later with Forgive Us Our Trespasses, although when I watched it at the time, that didn't exist. However, I'm going to dock it maybe a point or two because I didn't really quite feel all of the casting was there, like you said, with Paolo. I'm not going to say that I hate on him, but you know, we're looking at it from a whole kind of from soup to nuts. So for that, I'm probably going to knock it down from Duncan Caradwyn to Connor Kurgan for me, because I think that it's Connor Kurgan still. It's a great score.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very strong episode. But if you had the right child actor, say like the young Bernard with Duncan,
mm-hmm,
it would have elevated that part of the story, and I think you would have felt a little bit more of the plight of that character, the plight of Paolo and how he's trying to save his brother.
Actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because the casting for the other gang members, I didn't think was very good either.
Right.
In hindsight, because those guys did not seem threatening at all.
No. And you wanted to feel that moment when Paolo's like, when Caradwyn's about to basically kill her brother, his brother.
Right.
You didn't quite feel the same emotional content the way when little Bernard killed Ernst Daimler, when he was a boy with a pitchfork. And with that emotional content, I think that this thing would easily be Darius.
Yeah.
That it takes you out of the episode because those performances and that relationship weren't nearly as strong as they needed to be.
Right. Yeah. But in my mind, with the flashbacks and all that other stuff, I'm gonna give it an 8, a solid 8 with Duncan Carradine. So
fair to say. So any last thoughts, Mike, before we close this out?
I just want to say, like, just a general thing. I've been getting into like the CCG. Second edition stuff. Mm-hmm. Just ordered a bunch of cards. I'm waiting for him to show up so I can be like a giddy little schoolgirl. But a lot of the cards, I gotta say, like, look very interesting. I'm hoping that when I get the versus deck, I can get Warren down to like play a game and have a better review for you guys. But
I think you should record that. I think you should record.
Yeah, I think if Warren comes, I'll at least do an audio recording, if not a video.
For all the listeners out there, when Mike and I were really like hip deep into the game, like literally, like if you actually dumped all of our collections onto the floor, we would be hip deep in cards. Warren was one of our four horsemen and one of the best deck designers out there that I've played against, including Mike. You know, it's like Mike and Warren were these great deck designers. I just got lucky against him, especially against Warren for sure.
Yeah. Oh, you still got lucky on that one. Because he was playing his Fitz deck, right?
His Fitz Fast Talk pre-signature Fast Talk deck.
So right. So that, because it was like right when it came. And you had your, because I was in that same tournament. That was the 98 championship or New Jersey State Championship game. You were playing
deck, right?
I was playing Carradwin.
Oh, fortuitous that we're talking about that deck.
Yeah. And so like, because Warren kicked the snot out of me with his Fitz deck at that time, because I couldn't get anything out, and like he's playing like, you know, Rapier, Parrying Blade with all of these flurry strikes and all these other attacks, and he had it set up like with his flurry strikes that like every other flurry strike does an additional point of damage, so he'd have like five or six attacks out, so you're getting like 6, 7, 8 points of damage in one round if you couldn't, you know, block all that stuff. So it was like one of his insane deck ideas.
For those of you out there who don't know the card game, basically what Mike's talking about is a deck that's so finely tuned that you literally will die in 2 turns.
Right.
Or possibly 1.
So yeah, I mean, like, if you definitely don't have a lot of time. And that's where my deck really fell short, because Caradwyn's ability is she gets all these additional attacks for all her allies in play. Well, if you don't have the allies out on the table, they're not in play. So, like, I was stuck with, like, 1 or 2 attacks at most. Mm-hmm. And then by the time I got all this stuff out, like, he's already got me whittled down to where I couldn't really do anything.
I don't think that she was I think she was a great immortal. I don't think she was a good tournament immortal. You know, because tournament players play on speed and kind of bending the rules as much as they could.
I mean, if she'd have had, like... that was the problem too with Canis, who I thought was a good immortal for like to really get at you know, with the hounds. Mm-hmm. But you needed to have like that Master's Edge card to like put 2 immortals out at once.
Right.
I mean, 2 allies out at once.
They're fun. They're fun to play for fun, but those aren't the immortals you want to take into tournament.
I still think if the game had lasted a little longer and there was more time, I think I got to probably come up with something for her. Because I mean,
Fitzcairn.
Huh?
You really think so? Against his Fitzcairn deck, you really think so?
Well, it's something too. Like if I had a ripped.
Oh, go ahead. Rip his 1 fast talk, and he has 2.
Right. Well, that, like you said, like that was pretty.
Like I said, we're wholly digressing here, and this is going to be a completely different show. But it's these are great memories for Mike and I when we talk about we could talk about this thing for the next day or so, but aside from that, though, Mike, you know, this is a great episode pick. We're going to be coming back, folks, with part 2 of the Chamoli's Choice, because we're going to be doing the actual commentary on this episode where you and I are going to be talking live when we watch the show. And that's going to be a lot of fun, because there's sometimes we'll find things in an episode that we didn't really find when we're doing, you know, our dissection of it in this in this particular deep dive into this show. But until then, and I know that you want to talk cards, Mike, but you know we have to wrap up the show, and we're going to get back into it a little bit more. It's been great talking about your choice. I think it's a really strong choice. Take Back the Night is such a good episode, and I think that you're right. I think that it kind of like falls into the wake of the Mythos trilogy, and I think that's it's unfair that people may think it's not quite up to par. But if you take that out of the equation, I think it's a very strong choice, and it's a great episode, and it's been great talking about that. But this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about here on the Fandom Podcast Network. Recently on Blood of Kings and some of the shows that you've already listened to, but we just want to make sure that some of the new fans have gotten a chance to listen to some of these shows. We've talked about a really fun topic was Desert Island Highlander, where the Desert Island Challenge kind of allowed Kevin and I to pick some of our top choices of what we love about Highlander. And then we had Sean Dempsey's Valkyrie Part 1 and 2, where we talked about that really fantastic Season 5 episode when it comes to... we love talking about Duncan versus the Nazis, like Indiana Jones versus the Nazis. And then we just recently talked about Highlander Rocks. That was the... discussion we had with Aaron Gill and Kevin about Queen's A Kind of Magic and our first foray into talking about the music of Highlander. And then just recently, we had Culture Clash number 50. Yes. Culture Clash has celebrated their big milestone episode, number 50 episode. And congratulations to Kevin and Kyle on hitting that really huge anniversary. We're almost there, Mike. We're almost there on our 50th show. This is 48. We're almost there. And on their show, they hit some really interesting topics about, say, Game of Thrones, how Game of Thrones, the final season, is going into these larger format length episodes, 80-minute plus episodes. They're going to be kind of like more mini movies like Sherlock.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think they want to tell their final season as these really great epic pieces, so I think that's a smart move on their part. Mike, do you watch Killjoys on Sci-Fi?
Yep.
Do you like Killjoys on Sci-Fi?
Oh, I'm trying to keep my response to that very PG right now.
Do you love Hannah John Kamen?
Oh,
Killjoys?
Heck yes.
So you and Kevin are going to have to mud wrestle for her because that's Kevin's on-screen wife, his TV wife, as he says, quote unquote. I love Killjoys. I think it's a smart show.
It's a great, and I think Paolo directed some of those too. Barshman.
You were saying that earlier. Yep. There has been some interesting things on going on with Star Wars on the Barustu segment here on the Culture Clash 50, and I don't know. Do you think that there's as much drama as they're talking about with the directors leaving Han Solo? I mean, is that just news for news' sake?
For me, it's one of those things where.
Do you care?
I just want to see a good movie. You know, it's like the potential for the material is there.
Right.
The thing I found more disturbing though is I caught a snippet somewhere. I can't say where, that they weren't happy with the actor, his acting chops. They were sending him to acting classes for the young.
Well, maybe Han. Acting class, or maybe classes that help him emulate more Harrison Ford than anything else.
I really don't know. So maybe the between the casting and what they're seeing in dailies from this young actor who's maybe not as strong. Mm-hmm. I mean, George Lucas did it all the time. Like the kid that played the Anakin in the first movie in the Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
I hate to rag on the kid because I know he's had like lots of emotional things and he's very mad at the world because of Star Wars.
Jake Lloyd.
Yeah. I mean, like, I didn't think he was a strong actor. I mean, but in all honesty, like, Lucas was never good at casting actors. He lucked out so bad with, like, Hamill, Fisher, and Harrison Ford.
Yeah. I'll give you that. Yeah, with the whole thing with Star Wars, I'm like, guys, you know what? Everyone relax. It's going to be fine.
Yeah.
Consternation is only about selling newspapers. So, but here's the funny thing is like they reviewed Baby Driver and Transformers last night, and I know Baby Driver's killing it right now, but wasn't the actor in Baby Driver also considered, the lead actor also considered for Han Solo? So I'm wondering if there's like buyer's remorse with like the producer saying like, oh man, Baby Driver's killing it right now because of this kid. We really should have gotten him. But, you know, hindsight's 20/20 and blah, blah, blah.
Baby Driver, if you haven't seen it, dude, see it.
No, I will. I got to catch up on a lot of stuff. I got to catch up on Baby Driver and Spider-Man. And I know, I will. I promise. And then there's Transformers Last Night, which for some odd reason was able to rope in Sir Anthony Hopkins. But hey, everyone loves a paycheck, right?
Yeah. I mean, like, that was the only reason I was going to go see it, because not the biggest Michael Bay fan. But when I saw that little bit with like sort of like a King Arthur-y type thing with, and then like, you know, Hopkins, it's like, you know, I kind of want to watch it just to find out what that was about. I'll probably not enjoy the rest of the movie, but I'll see it for that. You know, like when it comes out on cable, I'll watch it.
Yeah, I'll wait until HBO, right?
Yeah.
So here's the cool thing, though, on 50, and this is something, Mike, I think you and I actually saw this together when we were in school. Kevin's Video Vault, which is awesome. He does these really funny deep dive picks. He picked Quick and the Dead, the Gene Hackman, Russell Crowe, Sharon Stone Quick and the Dead.
And Leo DiCaprio.
Didn't we see that together?
Yeah, I think we might. Yeah, we did. And I know I bought the Laserdisc when it came out, too.
Right. That's a super cool. That's a fun. I mean, it's not like the deepest Western in the world, but I'll tell you what. If you want to see a movie that showcases guns, like Western guns, that's the movie to see.
And it also has Bruce Campbell.
It does have Bruce Campbell. We saw that scene. And I think that even you said that you liked Russell Crowe's gun spinning more than you liked Michael Biehn's Johnny Ringo gun spinning in Tombstone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, like, I've been like, really digging the time warp stuff that they were doing, too.
Well, we're going to get into that because, in you know, with 50, and congratulations on hitting 50, guys, with the Culture Clash, we have Kevin's next big project that he's been doing, which is Time Warp 1987, the movies. Now, part one and part two is out right now, and I know that he's waiting for me. Thank you so much, Kevin. God bless you. For part three, Mike, I know that you want a part of that, so I think that you should just, I don't know. If Kevin's sending you 20, maybe you want to send him 20 back to get him on that.
I'll cancel his debt.
Call it a wash. But the reason why that this show is so fun for us, because we did 1986 in multiple parts on Time Warp when it was formerly known as the Fandom Podcast Flashback. And 1986 and 1987, in my opinion, are neck and neck when it comes to the influence that they've had on pop culture. So watch, when you're watching like the movies from 1987, they are huge tentpole movies. And if you're drinking the Blood of Kings podcast, that's right. Take a giant drink because I said tentpole. Tentpole is one of my big words, right? There you go.
Mm-hmm. So
you have great movies in 1987. You know, Lethal Weapon, you have Predator, and you have, I mean, just, let's see. I think they wanted me on for, why do they want me on for 87? Oh, yeah, Masters of the Universe. So you have a lot of great movies. They've just covered The Secret of My Success, Beverly Hills Cop 2, The Untouchables, Predator, Spaceballs, right? American Ninja 2, ninja movies were huge in the 80s, The Witches of Eastwick, Full Metal Jacket, and Living Daylights on part two. So that was a huge, huge, huge segment of Time Warp 1987. If you haven't listened to either of those, listen to those right now. And then wrapping up what we do here on the Fandom Podcast Network, we have Davis Grayson doing Couch Potato Theater, and he's just finished up some great shows dealing with Planet of the Apes. Yes, the original Planet of the Apes, not the new ones, either Apes with Clothes and G.I. Joe the Movie. And then we have our friends doing the Good Evening podcast, our friends Tom Caldwell, Brandon Shea Motella, and Chris Haig, and they are huge fans of Alfred Hitchcock, and if you are a fan of Hitchcock, you want to listen to this podcast. So before we close out the show, Mike, is there anything you'd like to say that you just need to get off your chest?
Nah, it's just been a pleasure like chatting about this episode with you and nerding out like it's like old times. Oh, you know, it's like we could be getting to the diner right now.
The next time we do this, let's just nuke up some disco fries and try and take it to that next level during the commentary. Although maybe people might like you're like during the commentary.
Yeah, it'll be rough because I can't like. You just can't have one.
No. And they are, I'm going to have to take a Lipitor with them because I really, it's, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that because like, if you've made it to this part of the podcast, folks, and you're listening to the end, One of the great things about one of the things that I love about doing Blood of Kings, one of the great things that have come of it, is my nostalgia and love for Highlander. It's always been big, but it's never been bigger than at these moments when I do the show. And Mike and I have talked endless hours about Highlander, more than you can possibly imagine, from the card game to the movies,
the episodes,
TV episodes, to when the episodes were airing live, to when we would talk about him until the wee hours of the morning, until I smoked probably like half a carton of cigarettes when I was a smoker back then. I've kicked that habit many years ago, but these are my Jersey days. They're fond memories for me, and Mike's a huge part of those, and I thank Mike every single time that he comes on the show, and also for editing the show and doing a great job. So it's always a pleasure, Mike, to have you on the show and talking Highlander with you, because it's a huge, it's like a rich history for you and I.
Yeah.
Together.
And it's fun walking down memory lane here.
Yeah, it is. And I look forward to the time we can actually do this together. So until we do this again for the commentary version of Take Back the Night, I'm Norm. And behalf on my co-host, Mike, thanks everyone for listening. And join us again next time here on the Fandom Podcast Network for another episode of Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast. Mikey, that sensation you are feeling is the hardening of your arteries because of that that huge order of disco fries that we just ate. We are one. We are brothers. Goodbye, everyone. Oh.